Here is a description of a play called Old School by Harvey Williams. He runs a Kansas City theater company called The Melting Pot. He also writes plays, directs plays, and does a whole bunch of other stuff. But this play he wrote a long time ago is being turned into a movie, and a trailer for it is showing at the Fringe Festival. Harvey is here with me now, and Harvey, can you read this little blurb? It'll sound so much better in your voice than mine.
He's called Old School. Old man in shabby clothes on any corner, any city. Always in your face with advice and life lessons. Bottle instead of Bible in hand, preaching a ghetto gospel. Who is that man? And why that corner?
So what's the answer? Who is that man? Why that corner?
Well, that's kind of what the play, the screenplay is about. These are people who are visible, yet invisible, in every city. It deals primarily with urban condition. It deals with family, generations. It's kind of the adage of you can't judge a book by its cover.
You know, on the face of it, you and this man you're describing would not have a whole lot in common. You're a family man, wife, children, grandchildren. You're very much visible. You run a theater company. You perform on stages. You're very much not the invisible, anonymous person on the corner with a bottle instead mm-hmm. of a Bible in hand. But is there something in this old school character that you relate to?
Absolutely. And that is my own personal history, my own personal family experience, my own experience growing up in the type of environment, neighborhood that I kind of describe, throughout this particular production. So it's just telling a bit of my story from, a different point of view.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today's show is a portrait session with Harvey Williams. His story as a lifelong Kansas Cityan who fell into theater after his time in the service, and now he's doing his darndest to create what you might call a black theater scene in Kansas City when he probably has what it takes to go somewhere else, somewhere that's already got a thriving black theater scene that could serve him instead of the other way around. Harvey Williams, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So, when I say that phrase, black theater scene, what does it mean to you?
A little bit of confusion. Black-owned theater as opposed to a black theater. There's a distinction there. I'm black. I founded the theater. Therefore, it's black-owned. But the theater is to tell stories. Now, stories coming from me are going to be predominantly about just what we just talked about, my experiences, especially original things that I do. But I also want to be a platform for other people, black people, white people, Latino, whatever it is. Those people also have stories to tell. So the key word is, black-owned theater with stories that people have to tell. Those people will bring their own identity to whatever is presented.
Have there been, in your mind, enough platforms for people of all different backgrounds to tell their stories, or is that part of what you're trying to create?
There definitely have not been enough. And that kind of pulls into this whole diversity issue that's really an issue nowadays. And to me, it's kind of like saying, I'm going to be a doctor. That's fine, but there are about 1,000 different avenues you can go in that profession. Diversity to me is the same way. I think for theater, it's more about diversity. It's more about the space. Diversity is there. You walk out your door, open your eyes, you're experiencing diversity, especially in the city. But you go into certain spaces and you don't see that diversity.
Yeah, it disappears.
Yes, exactly. So to me, it's more about the space. what is the issue with having diversity in the space?
Tell me about the melting pot, the idea behind it, how it works.
Well, the idea behind it started out innocently enough as me just wanting to put on Old School.
The play we just talked about, which is becoming a movie.
Right. Originally, it was kind of written as a screenplay, but that was tossed away because there's no way that's going to happen. And so kind of when I retired from teaching, and I was still very much involved in theater, I had some time to either sit on the porch and watch the mailman run up and down the street or do something constructive. So my passion has always been in writing. And so I looked at it as an opportunity to, okay, I'm going to put this show on. And it started out with just, that was the whole idea about it, to put this one show on and then go back and sit on the porch. Well, through some advice I was given by my wife, Linda Williams, about how you don't take something good or something you're passionate about and just do it once. It needs to have some continuity with it, some follow-up, some, you know, push behind it. And so from that, I decided with the help of a gentleman named David Brown to form a company, and it would be a theater company. And it would concentrate a little bit on just telling stories, you know, telling stories people had to have. And I wanted it to be a platform for people who typically didn't get an opportunity. There's always been a lot of quote theater in Kansas City, but the opportunities, and again, like we said, the spaces, were very narrow, you know, for some people. It was, you know, a little bit of who you knew, who you didn't know, you know, what you could do to get involved. And so from that standpoint, I wanted, the Melting Pot to be a platform for, you know, for this expression.
How do you get away from the whole who you know and who you don't kind of thing? Like, how do you make it more of a democratic platform?
You have to be willing to, again, not judge a book by its cover. You have to be open to having people come in and say, I want to do this. I want to be, you know, I want to act on stage. I have something I've written.
People you've never met.
Right. And so you have to kind of trust them and look at what they have. And then from there, you have to be honest with them that, you know, from your, you know, the way you look at it, how you see it, okay, this is good or this needs work. But you can't just outwardly say, well, I've never heard of you. What have you done before? And that's the criteria. So it's a little bit about taking, you know, taking chances with people and giving them an opportunity to succeed or fail.
So it started with Old School, and mm-hmm. we've talked a little bit about that, but I haven't seen the play. The way I understand it from what I've read about it, it mm-hmm. sounds like it's about a kind of like an intergenerational story about people sort of like, I don't know, coming together who don't under normal circumstances maybe do that enough.
Right. It's about basically a family. This character, Old School, has lived his life, so to speak, made some mistakes, and he's still in the community that he was raised in. He's been incarcerated. He's out, and now he does have family, even though it's estranged. He has a daughter that he had to basically give away when he went to prison. There were circumstances involving all that. And now he's trying to reconnect with that daughter, and it's not going well. But outside of that, now she has a son. So he has a grandson. And the young man that she's involved with, he really sees himself, a lot of himself in, about doing things that will come back to, you know, to haunt you or you know, in the long run are not going to be good for you. And the story is about his attempt to stop him from repeating his mistake. It's a chance for him to relive where he took a left instead of a right.
Young people always love it when someone older than them steps in and says, I know what's happening here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they love it. And it's just like that old adage. Yeah, you can tell them the fire's hot, but until the hand goes in, you know, they don't really, you know, take it to heart. And that's very much what the story is like. He preaches and preaches, and his appearance doesn't fit what he's preaching. And people assume this and that about, you know, him on the corner drinking and things like that. And as it turns out, everything is not what it seems. And so it is a story about him attempting to educate, you know, the next generation. He's also trying to redeem what's left of his own family, you know, through doing what he's doing. So it's a very much of a family, I guess it's a family drama.
This is a conversation with playwright, actor, and director Harvey Williams. He's founded a theater company called The Melting Pot, and we'll talk more about theater later in the show. But for now, Harvey, you have mentioned that this play that you have written comes in part from the inspiration of the kinds of communities you have lived in and the way that you grew up. You grew up in Kansas City. Whereabouts exactly?
Originally, youngest memories, so to speak, were in growing up in Wayne Minor. At that time, it was called Wayne Minor Projects, or T.B. Watkins. It was later renamed. In the projects down off of old 12th and 12th and Vine, 12th and Woodland. And that was kind of my neighborhood, you know, those projects. And so naturally, that was the heart, the heat of the city, so to speak, for black people in Kansas City. And Kansas City was still, you know, pretty much kind of segregated. You went to, you know, maybe 31st Street. That was kind of the cutoff point. Over to Troost, maybe. That was about it.
What is the time period roughly that we're talking about?
Okay, this was probably in the late 60s.
Okay.
Yeah, late 60s. And so I grew up and went to school there, went to Catholic school, the real Catholic school.
The real Catholic school. What do you mean by that?
Nuns. Yeah. But these were, in my experience, they were a positive influence. There was discipline. From my experience, there was never any off, you know, center discipline, but there was definitely discipline. And so, it did give you a sense of, also recognizing that you had to be responsible for your behavior, you know, from a young age. And so, I started out in kindergarten going to St. Monica's. At the time, it was known as St. Monica's School. Later, it was renamed St. Joseph. And all the way through sixth grade, I think. At that point, we actually family moved, and I ended up finishing my grade school years at St. James over on 39th and Tracy, I believe, attended St. James Parish, and then went to high school at Bishop Lillis High School.
So Catholic school all the way through?
Yes.
When you say that it gave you a sense that you were responsible for your actions or something like that, can you give an example of something that, like a memory you have from your school years that really, like, demonstrates how your school setting taught you that?
Well, yeah. It was more of making sure that I was fortunate. I had both parents, you know, in our household. And it was a lot more of the communication with the parent as to what was going on with the child in school. And in my case, there wasn't a whole lot of education going on. It was, you know, more, you know, activity than education, so to speak. But from that, it was, you know, the parents were able to, you know, kind of, you know, guide the child a little bit better, I think, in terms of, okay, what's expected of them. And also,
are you implying that you were maybe like kind of a troublemaker?
Well, yeah, that's one way of putting it, I guess. But school was never a priority to me. But even then, it was still, you would recognize, even if it's through examples of other people, the quote, goody two-shoes that you went to school with. Even from them, though, you picked up some positive inference about things. So it was very much, for me,
like, you were, the idea being that you were just not going to just get away with something. It was going to, like, come home to roost.
Right. It was not something that you were going to do and then it was over. You were going to do it. It might be over for as long as you could hide it. But eventually, okay, you got to answer for what you did. And a good example of that is just with the regular schooling. You get away with playing every day and not doing your homework until the grades came out. Then it was time to answer. And so, you know, it was just that whole, you know, that whole pattern that was consistent in the education that kind of brought it home that, you know, you have to, you know, you're going to reap what you sow.
Yeah, day to day.
Yeah.
You grew up with a lot of siblings and you were like practically the oldest one, right?
Yes, we had a total of nine, where I had a total of, including myself, eight other brothers and sisters. One sister passed in infancy. So there were eight of us. I was the second to the oldest. I had older sister. She's still an older sister, Wanda. And I was the second oldest. So we all grew up in the same household. And like I said, it's almost unheard of now that we had the advantage of having both parents present there from the time we were born until, my father passed, a few years ago. My mother's still alive. But we had that so many people don't have. You know, we had the advantage of having just them present and being involved in our lives every day. But other than that, yeah, there was a lot of, quote, responsibility that came with being the second oldest, whether you wanted it or not. And so you were responsible for it until mother and father got home from work, making sure, okay, they're not supposed to be outside, so at least get them back inside before they get home. So there was some level of responsibility that you had to take and you were responsible for. So you didn't have a lot of time to be selfish. I think that was kind of the lesson, because you had to be responsible for someone other than yourself.
You know, when I think about you as a theater director now, I think sort of right now I'm thinking about that I have an older brother and he kind of played this role of like wrangling the younger siblings a lot.
Right.
And now he loves coaching kids sports.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's maybe something to be said for like this early training that you have in like wrangling people.
Yeah.
Like a troop.
Yeah. It's true in a lot of different areas also. All experience is valuable. And sometimes your most difficult experience can be what you're able to share with people, you know, at a later point that helps them out. An example is I taught GED studies through the state of Missouri, and I was teaching geometry and algebra. Well, those were absolutely my worst subjects all the way through school, through college. I'm sure there were some payoffs to some teachers along the line somewhere. But when I started teaching, it was necessary for me to teach those subjects. And so the first thing I pulled from was, what was it about them that I had difficulty with? And that kind of unlocked the key to being able to reach other students and, you know, get it through to them. Okay, this is how you get, you know, past that. So my hurdle turned out to be a door for them. Because I was able to relate to them on that level.
You know, I wonder if you were ever in a school play or anything like that as a kid.
I really don't remember being in any type of production until I was in the first production I was ever in, and that was in college. And so in our school, there wasn't a lot of, arts or, you know, so to speak. We had the little choir. I was in the band. I played the triangles.
I love the triangles.
Yeah, and the sticks. You remember?
Yeah.
Okay. That was it for me, you know, musically. But I don't really recall being in any type of artsy activity other than that.
I understand that you fell in love with theater in college, but before that you actually joined the service. Tell me about that decision.
Yeah, that was out of high school. At that time, this is going back. The Vietnam War was winding down, but they were still very much at war. And there were still, the draft was going on, and there were people from, you know, going in and getting sent, to the war. After high school, I decided to join the service. It was kind of that romantic thing about, wanting to, serve your country, do the right thing. Which was great and sounded great, didn't sound so great to my parents, but...
You just did it and then told
them?
Yeah,
I just did. I pretty much just went down and signed up, you know, once I turned 18 and had graduated. I went down, signed up, and the summer after I graduated, we graduated, what, May or June.
Was this just kind of a casual decision that you made, or was it something you really thought about? And
no, I definitely didn't think about it. I thought about it.
Interesting the way, like, an 18-year-old makes a decision like that.
Yeah, well, you know, at that age, you're invincible. You think about, it's very much like being in the theater business. You think about a great story, and then you think about the production and everybody standing, applauding, loving it. But you don't think about, excuse my language, the hell in between the idea and the production. And that's kind of the way it was with me. I thought about how great it was to, you know, serve your country, come back, and people, you know, kind of, you know, respect what you did, and you did your fair share. But you don't think about the body bag and the friends that you went to school with that do come back in those. So from that standpoint, no, I did not think about it really. It was more, okay, bravado, I think. And also, but still wanting to contribute. You know?
What was it like when you actually went?
The service, honestly, at that time, was probably, again, now I had, like I said, gone to Catholic school, so there wasn't an amount of discipline I was used to. But in the service, I have to say that was probably the greatest socialization experience that I had. Because I was raised in the city, you know, the whole time. But when I joined the service, of course, then I met people from all over the country, other cities, as well as the rural areas. You know, individuals from, you know, Appalachia, places like that. And these were truly people I did not know. And the one thing the service did, because they don't care about anything except you're going to follow the rules, you're going to do what you're ordered to do, is we were all in the same boat, so to speak. And that human thing about, even if this person is not somebody you really care about or relate to, if it's you and him keeping each other going, you develop, you know, a relationship.
I mean, when we talked earlier about diversity, this sounds mm-hmm. like
this oh, yeah,
is the, diversity.
This was a diversity, and this was kind of the you know, spoon-fed, so to speak, diversity. Like, you did not have a choice. And you either survived with it, you learned how to deal with it, or you didn't. And so, fortunately, I think I came out well with it. I made some good friends. There were people I went in with that when I left, you know, we weren't so good friends. But it was still the experience and learning how to deal with different people.
Harvey Williams, stay with me through the break, okay?
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. We're doing a portrait session with Harvey Williams, who runs the Melting Pot Theater here in town. Born and raised in Kansas City, has played a lot of characters on Kansas City stages, and now he's trying to create a space for everyone to have their say in the bigger story we're all telling. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're hearing the story of Harvey Williams. His current project is running the Melting Pot Theater Company here in Kansas City. It's an African-American-owned theater company, but Harvey's already had a long career playing all kinds of parts in major productions, as well as writing his own plays. I want to hear about some of those experiences, but we still need to, like, introduce you to theater, Harvey. We haven't even gotten there yet, and I'm very excited to hear that story. You came back from the service and went to UMKC.
Yes. I had picked up some credits while I was in the service through the military college, University of Maryland. But then I came back and I wanted to finish my bachelor's degree. And so I enrolled at UMKC under the GI Bill and went into communication studies. Still no theater on the horizon. You know, there was nothing there about theater. But then I took some classes, some electives, and one of those electives was an intro to theater 101 or whatever. And the one of the instructors I had was Richard Allen Nichols, who's still very much, he's an icon in Kansas City theater. And he was a great instructor, and he was doing a production of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead at Park College. And he asked if anyone would be interested. He said he was looking for diversity, because he asked if I would be interested in playing a role in it. And I, you know, he was the teacher, so I was very much interested. He indicated that it would help my grade. So I ended up, that was my first experience. It was kind of being, you know, invited to be, you know, in a production. I knew nothing about theater. I remember the production was at Park College, and I remember how confused I was on the stage, not understanding what anyone was saying. This was, of course, a Shakespeare, you know, Shakespeare, and I had no experience with that. I was learning about it, but it was still very much foreign to me. And so that was my first experience. It's almost like a haze when I think back to it, because I don't remember the particulars, except that I did enjoy it. And I remember watching the other people on stage and how they, I guess I was getting my first lesson, how those actors, who were really actors at that time, bought into these parts they were playing, which allowed me to start my process of learning how to do that. And so that was my first experience with theater.
Early on in your career, I mean, you've mentioned that you were a teacher. And I don't know if this is still true or not, but you had day jobs. Like, you had other things going on.
Oh, absolutely. While I was going to UMKC, I was also, I worked at Jackson County Juvenile Court. I was a youth worker at that time. Once I finished my degree at UMKC, I went on full time there as a deputy juvenile officer for juvenile.
What does
court.
That mean exactly? What did you do?
Well, we supervised juveniles who were, you know, what we call, you know, status offenders or, you know, had violated, you know, the law, you know, vandalism, things like that. We would have to work with them, kind of do a family history on them, prepare recommendations if they had to go to court, to juvenile court, prepare recommendations, follow-up plans for, you know, how to, you know, help deal with, you know, the situations they were in. And so that was very much like, you know, being a social worker, so to speak. And that was an eye-opening experience, job also, because, again, when I talk about family and a lot of the things I do, that was the first experience that I really recognized when I'm dealing with these young people. The problem is not necessarily them, but it's before them. It's the parent, because the parent didn't have the skills or didn't put in the time. And then it was just a repeat because this child was growing up the same way. So it got to be, a big learning experience. I also had some part-time jobs. I worked as a security guard. I worked for an insurance company doing underwriting, things like that, you know, processing files. And so I had a lot of different jobs. Then I finally got involved with the school district as a instructor. I got certified as a adult education instructor, and primarily started doing that, you know, contracted through the state of Missouri.
You know, it's a lot of material to draw on. And I know no one likes to think of their authentic life experiences as quote unquote material, mm-hmm. but truly you have a lot of material to draw on.
Yeah. And that's kind of, so to speak, I guess my wheelhouse in terms of when I write any of the things that I write. I could not write fiction. I could never write a episode of Star Wars. That is not in me. You know, that
a faraway galaxy. No.
Yeah. No. I can barely watch it. But the real life experience, like seeing some people. I did a play called On Shoulders Now. It's a Christmas story, and it all came from at the theater at Just Off Broadway. Behind us there are some woods, and there are a lot of homeless people, and there was one Christmas and. Where we're located is on Main Street, and I drive down Main. I leave the theater, and I'm seeing a little glow back up in the woods where they've got some little campfires going. It's around Christmas. And then I'm driving down Main toward the plaza, and all of a sudden I see the glow of the Christmas lights on the plaza. And I think, it's Christmas in both places. There's a glow in both places. but the glows are totally different. And so it's just that kind of thing. That's what moves me and gives me a passion for creating stories and fleshing out who people are. Because, you know, the heroes are every, you know, shape and form, and so are the devils.
You've had some big roles in Kansas City productions, which I've mentioned, in plays like Driving Miss Daisy, mm-hmm. The Piano Lesson, Fences, Othello. Can you tell me about some of the iconic roles you've played and what those experiences were like for you?
All of them were great. The first main role, I guess, I had was at American Heartland Theater, where I did Driving Miss Daisy. And Linda Brandt was actually, she was the director of that show.
What year are we talking about?
Oh, I have no idea.
You know, the movie came out in 1989. Right. I was sort of looking back over this because that has become a very controversial movie.
Exactly. And so I just know, whatever year that the Heartland did it, I'd done it at a couple of community theaters, and then I auditioned to do it there and got the role there. But I remember just, for instance, that story.
And can you recap it for people who may be like of a generation where they wouldn't have seen this movie?
Okay. Well, it's about the situation in the South during the Civil Rights Movement, Martin Luther King. And there's a family, and the matriarch of the family, her name is Daisy. They call her Miss Daisy, the title of the play. And she's a widow. And she still maintains her home, and she's got a son called Bully. And she has also a chauffeur who she really doesn't want to have because she's no longer able to really drive without going through the garage. So her son hires this chauffeur for her. He's a black chauffeur.
Played in the movie by Morgan Freeman.
Morgan Freeman, yeah. His name is Hoke Coburn. And it's just a story of their relationship. Really, it turns out to be a story of the relationship between this man and this woman. However, in this era, it's a black man and a white woman, and it's in the South. So you tie all that into it, and it was not necessarily a, quote, love relationship between them, but it was a love relationship because out of the animosity of her not wanting him around, to him just being there because he needed the job, and he saw opportunity, they developed kind of like the service situation. You're lumped in together, you make the best out of the situation. And by the end, they had been through some things that just brought them together. So by the end, they were all each other had. They were best friends.
So I don't want to make like a huge thing out of Driving Miss Daisy, but I am really curious about how you feel having played the role because it has, I was looking this up to refamiliarize myself and I found a headline that I think kind of sums it up. The headline is How Driving Miss Daisy Became One of the Most Scorned Best Picture Winners Ever. Mm-hmm. And then in 2008, actually Spike Lee said that when Driving Miss Mother Bleeping Daisy won Best Picture, that hurt. What is he talking about there?
He's talking, I think, about kind of the condition that we find a lot of the conversation going on today about the diversity, but also about the truth in storytelling. This story was written, and one of the main characters in it was a black character. But the black character was, he turned out to be, quote, a positive character, but it was maybe had more to do with how the story was written about the white characters. In other words, this white savior, kind of thing that's going on. Now for me as
like,
an actor,
oh, how wonderful that she actually befriended this guy.
That's right. And he got to do it. But the parts of the story I remember are when he basically berated her. I mean, just when she would take the position of superiority and he would just more or less break it down to her like, look, whatever the situation is socially, if you want me to do something, you talk to me, like I'm a man. Particularly one time when he wanted to stop and use the restroom. And she told him, no, keep. And he stopped the car in the middle of the road and said,
and this is the role you played.
Yeah. And he said, look, I'm a man. you don't tell, I know when my bladder's full, you know, just very basically, don't tell me that. So the parts that I really remember are the parts where he exerted that he was a man.
His humanity.
Yeah, his humanity. And the rest of it, the fluff, so to speak, which made the movie popular with them being friends at the end. At the end, he's feeding her a piece of pie or whatever. You know, it's a nice story, but it's probably was at that time presented more like a fairy tale than the real deal, even though they did mention lynching in the play, where he talks about how him and some of his friends, you know, found one of their fathers hanging from a tree one time. They talk about bombing of a Jewish synagogue. There are some pieces in the play that resonate. And when I think about movies and how you can have a great movie and tell a great story and be 100% truthful, but it gets to Hollywood and they say, well, we don't really want to tell that part. So we'll make it look like it was a party instead of a lynching. You know what I mean? It those elements were there. It was obvious that, okay, as soon as you tell this, then you go right back and, you know, it's like a seesaw. You can't be honest enough to let the weight fall where it should fall. And so I think from that standpoint, that was one of the first recognitions that these stories, who was telling these stories? If you're going to tell a story about a black man in the South, it's probably going to be more authentic if it comes from a black person who experienced that in the South or who grew up experiencing it or seeing it, you know, happen.
Well, that gets to who writes the plays, and mm-hmm. and that writing a play gives you one kind of voice, acting in a play another kind of voice. What was the first play you wrote? Was it Old School?
Yes, actually, Old School was the first my first effort. I wrote it. At the time, I was involved with a group called MC Players. They were from Kansas City, Kansas. Mr. Martin Chisholm, Granville O'Neill, and some other people were involved in that. And they were a black community theater group, and they did a lot of things here in Missouri.
When was this?
I have no idea.
Okay, go
That's
on.
My story. I mean, I really,
fair date-wise. Enough.
But considering Old School's, you know, 15, 20 years ago, this had to be, because that's when I wrote it, when I was involved with them. And so I wrote it, Martin read it, and he kind of found it interesting. And so they decided to put it on. And that was kind of the origins of the first writing. And what thrilled me about it was that he recognized, again, a black man wrote it. Martin was black. He's a black director. He could recognize those characters like I could. So when he's directing them on stage, there's continuity. The actors were black, so they understood the story too. And so I think from that standpoint, it's where you get the origin. Who is the story about? Who is telling the story? And who's going to show the story, you know, on stage?
You know, can you tell me about some of the other Kansas City playwrights you've been working with at the Melting Pot, some of the stories they're telling, the way they're telling them, and the way this is sort of playing out in your work now?
Okay. Well, some of the people we've been involved with, they don't necessarily work, you know, at Melting Pot. But one playwright I've been involved with is, her name is Michelle Johnson.
She works at KCUR.
Oh, does she? Oh, she has a job. I didn't know that. but she is a fabulous, and I mean fabulous, writer. And she's very much a testament to the purity of how a story is told. And she's also...
What do you mean by that?
Because when she writes a word on the page, and I learned this from experience, don't change her word. She wrote that word for a reason. Even if that reason doesn't show up until the last word is spoken. If she wrote it on page one, leave it there. It's going to flesh itself out. But by that, I mean she is very clear on what the message she's putting out. She's also very aware of who this message is going to resonate with. She'll be the first one to tell you, well, I'm not going to get a lot of people coming to see this because they're not going to agree with this. That does not stop her from telling that real story.
Why is it important to you to go ahead and put the play on, even if not a lot of people are likely to come see it?
Because if it's a story that carries weight, a few people seeing it is more valuable than 100 people seeing some fluff, as far as I'm concerned. Because then you can grow that. You can grow truth, just like you can grow fantasy? And what's more valuable?
Harvey Williams is my guest on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. We've got to take one more break. We will be right back. Stay with us. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and this is a portrait session, which means the story of our guest, Harvey Williams, will be up online over the weekend with photographic portraits by the talented Paul Anders. And Harvey, I have seen Paul's photos of you, and this might sound like a really weird thing to say, but you have a very evocative face, which in most cases is an observation I would leave alone, keep to myself. But with acting on a stage where you get no close-ups to capture subtle expressions, I actually kind of think faces matter. So want to talk about your face for a second?
Okay, well, it was come to that. Yes, I guess we can.
How do you, as an actor, think about your face?
I really don't think about it as much as an actor. What's happening at a particular time on stage, and sometimes that's it gets in the way of stage as opposed to if you're doing film, because a little bit of a twitch on film can be a close up that it's very obvious. Whereas a little bit of a twitch on stage is not even noticed by the audience. And so you have to exaggerate it. So depending on the medium, but if you're talking about stage, I look at it from the standpoint that there's a camera in my face. And so, because that way I think I give the truest amount of visual presentation of what I'm trying to express. If there are gestures that go along with it, you can make it bigger for stage. A hand wave, you can make an ocean wave. as opposed to if you're on film again, you can just flick the wrist a little and you got the wave. So it's understanding what medium you're from. But I think the purest medium, and I think that's why a lot of mainstream actors and actresses love to get back to stage, because they get to really be real in the story in real time. And that makes a difference on. So my face, I think, is just, I'm just a victim of, genetics for one thing.
And then, no.
Yeah. And then after that, it's just, I don't really think about it. And that's probably why I'm one of those people, I don't really like to see myself on camera. And I think that's why maybe some actors are like that, where they say they don't really like to watch themselves. Because they live the truth of the moment, and to them it's odd, like going back and revisiting something that you put out that was genuine.
So maybe it's part of the what you're bringing to it is not overthinking every gesture.
Oh no, you don't have time for that. It's kind of like what they tell football players: don't think, get the ball to where it needs to go. And with acting, if you're able to really know the story. Understand the story, understand the other characters you're working with, you don't have time to think about your face. you're advancing whatever needs to be advanced on that stage to get this story told, the way it should be told.
You've got an August Wilson play coming up at the Melting Pot in the fall, and you are directing it.
Yes. We're going to open our season in September with King Hedley II by Mr. August Wilson. We did our first August Wilson production last year, and that was Radio Golf, and it was received very well. It was a great production. I directed that one also. And so this year, when we were talking about our season, Dr. Nicole Hodges-Pursley, who's our artistic director, we thought it would be strong to open up with another August Wilson piece. And so that's what we're doing with King Hedley. Some great actors in it, Mr. Louis Morrow, a great cast.
What's the story like in a nutshell?
Well, August Wilson did the cycle, the 10-play cycle. And in some manner of speaking, even though he did not write them in a certain order, they go in an order. And a lot of the storyline is about, the history of the Black experience through different decades. And so in each decade, this particular decade is in the you know, I think it's in the early 80s, along that time. And it's about a young man who has basically made some mistakes. He's been to prison. He comes back out, and now he's got to deal with what's out there for him. You know, what kind of, is there any opportunity left? The other characters involved are also, they're kind of victims of the time. You know, this time in American history for black people in the city. The cities were decaying, drug epidemic was really taking off. Crack was introduced. You had a lot of social upheaval. So this was a rocky time. But the thing about, like all of August Wilson's characters are, they all came from rocky times. And so there was a way that they could deal with them. And sometimes it was good, sometimes it wasn't so good. But there's just that thread of truth that goes through. And some of the characters in some of his different plays repeat themselves, and they reappear in other plays. And it's just the whole thread that he managed to weave with these stories that make it remarkable, because it is truly, when we talk about tradition and passing on tradition, I think it was his effort to keep this black experience alive. And the characters that he has doing that are tremendous, you know, and fill a lot of gaps in you know, the black experience.
You know, we've told the story about theater and your career somewhat. There are pieces we haven't gotten to, but the storyline of your family is one we've kind of let drop. And I want to pick it back up before our time is up, because mm-hmm. I understand that the work you do is really a family operation on some level, with many generations of Williamses kind of around and doing their thing.
Yes. Well, when we first started, it was absolutely outside of Mr. David Brown, who's helped in getting, you know, everything launched, and Jerome Berry. It was all family. It was my wife, Linda Williams, who is still to this day. She hasn't walked out yet.
Rumor has it she runs a tight ship.
Oh, absolutely. She's the general manager. She's the organization. She's that piece that comes in between the idea and the applause, the work part of it. She is there to make sure that gets done. Those pieces that have to be done to get, you know, to get something accomplished. My daughters, Tiffany, Tucker, Stephanie Williams, they were also instrumental. My granddaughter, Rihanna Tucker, Raina.
What is it like to have like many generations of your family all kind of pitching in on this vision?
Well, it's a little bit daunting, because they tend, you know, your children and grandchildren tend to listen to you when it's about something other than when you're trying to get them to do something they need to do. And so it's kind of, it makes you stop and wonder, okay, now am I doing this right? They're going to do what I tell them. So I've got to make sure I've got it right. And so it really, to me, it was evidence to me that I needed to understand this business. If I was going to pull them into it and we wanted it to be legitimate and successful, we didn't want to just have a lemonade stand. We wanted to have a lemonade stand where the people wanted the lemonade. And so that was the whole concept behind it. Not to start out trying to be, you know, quote, rich and famous, because that won't happen with theater, but to contribute, to tell stories that contribute to people learning, to be that platform for the young people who want to be part of this theater thing, but they always see it as, oh, that's for someone else. No, it's for you. You got a story? Write it down. You know, I've been to grade schools where I told the kids, write your story down, send them to me. We'll see what we can do.
At grade schools?
Yeah, because that's all it takes. They have a voice, they just haven't heard their voice.
What do you ultimately hope will be the legacy of all this work you're doing right now?
That it continues to be a platform, that it just spreads and it enables, like I said, young people and all people. The key word is people here. We're talking about diversity. So all people who have stories to tell if Melting Pot can be a platform for them to tell that story, then it's all good.
Harvey Williams, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Harvey's company's got some work in the Fringe Festival, and they'll be performing August Wilson's King Headley II this fall. Harvey will be directing that play. You can get all the info at kcmeltingpot.com. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with lots of help from Chris Young, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, and Kniggendorf, and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. We had extra support this week from Sam Zeff and Andrea Todd Hope. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman, over and out.